want to know what we're looking for in the Lerps? We want a special kind of person. Someone with an average of 13 and a half years education, 20 to 21 years old, even-tempered, likes the outdoors, is willing to undergo selective, intensive training, and can work in small groups. Then one last thing, preferably an orphan.
One of the most successful innovations of the war in Vietnam was the formation of the long-range reconnaissance patrols, LRPs.
LRPs, again, it's a ranger concept. Special forces use it as well. They use it particularly in their Greek Sigma and Omega organizations when they were doing, and SOG as well. It's just any special unit, small unit that goes far away from the parent unit. Rangers do it particularly, far away from the conventional unit that they're operating with. Sometimes beyond the artillery fan, sometimes not. But they just going out, way out in enemy territory, looking for, usually for multiple days, looking for intelligence. Generally, their rules of engagement are not to fire, unless fired upon. Keep yourself very, very quiet. Just look. Sometimes look and call in airstrikes, but stay unseen. That's basically the purpose.
On August 7, 1964, when Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, fewer than 24,000 Americans were in Vietnam. By 1968, 536,000 draftees and volunteers filled the ranks of the units fighting the war in Southeast Asia. When regular infantry units began to arrive in Vietnam, the U.S. Army had not fought a guerrilla conflict of any significance since the Philippines insurrection at the turn of the century. The first American combat troops arrived in country wearing uniforms and footgear designed for the parade ground, not this war's battleground. Fatigues were adorned with white name tags and bright multicolor patches. The basic infantry weapon was the bulky M14 rifle that was best suited for warfare on the plains of Europe. Air mobility was still in its infancy, so the young grunts went into battle as soldiers had done for generations, on foot. One thing was clear. If American forces were to have any chance of winning this war, they would need eyes and ears that could penetrate the jungle canopy and guide the overwhelming U.S. firepower on the lurking enemy. There were no long-range reconnaissance patrol or ranger units on the Army rolls at the beginning of the war. But as in every other instance in American military history, it did not take long before actual combat showed the big brass the need for the small mobile recon units. Captain Stephen Cobb experienced the LRPs firsthand.
LRP stands for Long-Range Recon Patrol, or LRRP. The Army lexicon, of course, having lots of initials and acronyms, we used to just call them LRPs. They had good field rations that you could just mix water with, and they were a favorite among the troops in Vietnam. Their mission was a very hazardous one. They would go out in small groups of 5 to 10, sometimes larger, but usually smaller, looking for concentrations of the enemy, whether it's headquarters or supply bases or enemy movements. This includes going out and looking on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They're very highly trained, very skilled. They're almost like special forces. In fact, many are special forces qualified. And their job was to find and report enemy positions, movement, headquarters, supply buildups, largely an intelligence role, and highly dangerous.
Operating for a week at a time in six-man teams, often out of the range of any friendly support, they were the eyes and ears of the infantry units they supported.
Dear Rhett, I'm living in a green world with green canvas roof over me, green sandbags all around me, dressed in green camouflage fatigues, and sitting on a green cot that once was white, but now mildewed. All around me are jungles of green where I live, fight, and will probably die. It is raining fairly hard. Fog has cut the visibility to 70 feet at noon and zero at night. I'm sitting here cold and wet, unbelievably dirty after 8 days in the field. Fairly miserable, yet strangely content. My team is supposed to be relieved today, but the weather has grounded the choppers. This also means that air support will be erratic at best, and non-existent at worst, in this weather if Victor comes up the hill. The merry life of a ranger in the Orient. George Olson, Company G, 75th Infantry, Ranger.
The Lerps were unsurpassed in their ability to provide timely intelligence, and their enemy body count often rivaled or exceeded ground units of far greater strength.
And the greatest picture I ever took in Vietnam was a line of 300 North Vietnamese Army regulars with pith helmets, regimental unit identification numbers, coming up the side of a hill, and they came within 5 yards of where I was hiding. And I took the picture, several pictures, in fact. Of course, the S2 immediately, the intelligence back at Brigade, immediately confiscated all these pictures and classified them, because we had found the regimental headquarters of the 22nd Regiment that our brigade had been looking for almost 3 months. And we landed almost in the middle of them. And we played a game of cat and mouse or hide and seek with these guys. And the Lerps were the ones who were the masters at this. Masters of disguise, masters of being able to move at night, masters of being able to hide during the day. And it was many times that North Vietnamese units, or sometimes Viet Cong units, came within a few feet of us, and they never saw us.
But when a live prisoner was needed for interrogation, command turned to the Lerps for these most dangerous missions.
Dear Red, last Monday I went on my first hunter-killer operation and saw Mars up close for the first time. We had 2 teams inserted at dawn, about 12 miles inland. We set up around a trail when a lone NVA officer walked into the middle of us. We tried to grab him, but he panicked and took off in a blizzard of shells. I had him in my sights. Threw 3 slugs at him. He just disappeared. No Hollywood theatrics. 1 minute he's a living, running human being. The next second, he's down, just a red lump of clay. After that, everyone in hearing distance knew where we were in the area. On hunter-killer operations, we stayed a fight rather than break contact. We moved out across some paddies when all hell broke loose. Our point man was less than 10 feet from the NVA when we were ambushed with grenades and automatic weapons. If they had a heavy MG or a mortar, we'd be dead. But as it was, we were lucky. Not a man was killed. Our NCO and point man assaulted the ambush force, and Victor broke contact and ran. It's hard to be a wolfhound in this country. George Olson, Company G, 75th Infantry, Ranger.
By hook or crook, by trickery or stealth, technology or technique, the Lerps perfected the craft of the snatch and grab in Vietnam. And for good reason, no intelligence source was more prized than a live, freshly snatched body. Hunting was good in the early days. In 1967, the Lerps grabbed 38 NVA officers and doubled that number of VC chiefs. But as the war went on, the enemy devoted more and more troops to counter the recon units.
By 66, North Vietnamese getting pretty used to these guys, start coming up with pretty good ways to counter them. There's only so many. They always come in by helicopter. Generally, the thing was you would come to several clearings, the helicopter would go down in all of them. One of them, the guys would get off. So anybody watching would just see the helicopter coming down. They wouldn't know which clearing they got off in. The problem is, there's only so many clearings in jungles of Laos.
A snatch meant initiating contact in dangerous areas against forces that usually outnumbered the teams 50 to 1. The typical mission would involve 8 men, 6 Lerps and 2 scouts. They would insert by air or river, depending on the target. Once they located their target, the team would set up a perimeter to protect the zone around the grab. The team leader and at least one of the scouts would go in and grab the prisoner. Fear of the men in green faces and total surprise could subdue the target. The unfortunate prisoner would have his hands bound and his mouth gagged. Then the team would move out as quickly as possible before the alarm could be given. When you grab someone, dragging the prisoner slowed the pace of the team toward the extraction point, while the counter-recon teams and local cadre chased all the harder because you had one of their own. The lessons learned from those types of missions would not only pay big dividends in Vietnam, but would also set the groundwork for similar operations in America's war on terror. Only 13 LERP units saw action in Southeast Asia. There was no central command and control for the force. Each LERP unit operated independently of the others. The LERP teams answered only to the parent unit it was assigned to scout for. LERP missions were characterized by extreme hardship, extraordinary attention to detail, and uncommon bravery.
Generally slow, slow moving quietly through dense underbrush that you just couldn't get very far. And so oftentimes you look at their plans, sometimes they would move a kilometer a day or even less sometimes, and through terrible, terrible jungle area or high mountains, that sort of thing. And just looking at a relatively small piece of real estate, trying to see what's out there, call that, like I say, call in airstrikes if it's worth it. In other words, if you see a patrol of North Vietnamese, who cares? If you see a regimental base, call in an airstrike.
The following is typical of the accomplishments of the recon trooper.
Well, the second time I was wounded was when we were on a long-range recon patrol or LERP mission, and we were 70 miles into enemy territory. And we got out to sneak around and see if we could find where the regimental headquarters of the bad guys were. In particular, we were looking for the 22nd NVA Regiment. We knew they were somewhere in the area, but we didn't know exactly where. So for 5 days and nights, there were six of us, we played hide-and-seek with the North Vietnamese Army Regiment. And we carried AK-47 rifles, so if they fired a signal shot, we'd fire one back and they'd think it's our own troops. We carried two radios in case one was destroyed and we had to evacuate. So after 5 days, we were finally discovered and we had to extract in a hurry. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And five of us had over 500 North Vietnamese bearing down on us. So we asked the helicopter, the U.S. Army and the U.S. Air Force fighters to please hurry up and get over there and protect our tails. And they were extracting us from a hilltop, and the North Vietnamese opened fire with mortars and machine gun fire. And the mortars immediately bracketed or landed on either side of our position. And as I was helping one of the men onto the helicopter, a mortar round exploded just behind me, and I was blown onto the floor of the helicopter. But we successfully lifted off. And Army medics, who usually are cute and have a good sense of humor, came over and started helping me. And my back was all bloody from where I'd been hit with multiple fragments. And I was hurting, and he said, "Do you need some morphine?" I said, "Well, I think it would be really appreciated." So he gave me a shot of morphine, and then he started picking metal out of my backside. And just after he started, and I was not real happy with the process, he said, "Well, how about a cigarette to help ease the pain?" And I told him I gave up smoking in college, and in a very condescending voice, he said, "Lieutenant, there are three times in your life when a cigarette tastes real good. One is after good food, two's after great sex, and three's after you've been shot. Now, you just qualified for all three, so pipe down and take a drag." And unfortunately, he was right on all three counts. It helped, and I've been smoking ever since.
The troops who volunteered for LERP duty were a unique group in a unique war. They were not super soldiers any more than the thousands of other brother warriors in the line units. Yet they performed super feats that earned the respect of friend and foe alike. The VC and NVA had little trouble following the buildup of American military forces in the South. What surprised them was that these round eyes would try to out-guerrilla the guerrilla. They would learn the hard way that these soldiers were very adaptable.
I think the special forces were unique because of their advanced training. They had to be qualified in multiple systems involving weapons, radio, medical. They had special language training. Their Some of training took over a year and a half before they could be qualified. They all had to be airborne qualified. And they weren't stuck on the hill. So in a way, they felt sorry for the grunt who was stuck on a hilltop or with a unit and who didn't have the freedom of movement. And part of their uniqueness was their esprit de corps, based on all of this training and their ability to move and their ability to shoot and communicate much more rapidly than those of us in the regular Army. But it also meant they were exposed to a greater level of danger. But again, the higher the level of danger, the more the camaraderie that exists. The only group that's really comparable to Special Forces would be Navy SEALs. And they have a tremendous camaraderie based on shared danger, very extensive training, which makes them uniquely qualified for many different roles in combat.
The first formal record that the Communists were aware that the LERPs were seeking them out came during Operation Austin II in April 1966. LERPs from the 1st Brigade of the 101st operating near Fontoot surprised and overran a small VC training camp on April 16th. The subject of the class was Beware American Long Range Patrol. Captured documents from the other operations revealed that the enemy's common name for the LERPs was the Men with Painted Faces. This was in reference to the green and black camouflage grease paint that the LERPs applied to all uncovered areas of their skin. As more and more units entered the war, the need for trained recon troops grew. On September 15, 1966, General William Westmoreland directed Colonel Francis Kelly, commander of the 5th Special Forces Group, to establish the Recondo School at Nha Trang. The veterans of Project Delta and the Laos operations became the instructors. LERPs now had a place to train and learn their skills, besides in the jungle, where one mistake could cost many lives. The school was modeled after the one Westmoreland had created for the 101st Airborne back in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in the late 50s.
I had a couple of more months at 1st Army Headquarters, and then I relocated to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, because my orders were to the 101st Airborne Division, which was now in Vietnam, up in the northern section just south of the Marines, up in the Way area. And, of course, everybody remembers the Battle of Way and the Marines' involvement at Way. And the 101st had been allocated a very, very, very large piece of geography to operate in. Now, if you have to understand that up until this period of time, 1968, the 101st Airborne Division is airborne. The men of the 101st were trained to jump out of aircraft. They were going to be employed as infantry. There were three brigades, there was three battalions per brigade, there was a massive support command, but the Army was changing. The mission of the 101st was still to go out, find and fix and eliminate the enemy, but they were changing the 101st to air mobile. The thinking was dramatic. For example, if we found the enemy, if we were at point A and we found the enemy 100 miles away, and we loaded them all in trucks, and if we walked, that would be a whole day of walking and driving and logistical support under the old concept of the employment of the 101st. Was that's the way it was done. But in Vietnam, in order to react, we had to find that enemy and we had to pounce on them. So that 100-mile distance, once we found the enemy, that 100 miles away, was 1 hour when we could drop or insert a whole battalion of 101st Airborne Troopers. So we were converting in 67 and 68 the entire 101st Airborne Division to air mobile.
For the most part, LERPs were young, cocky, foolishly brave, occasionally arrogant, and individualistic. Rank did not mean a thing. Recruitment for officers for the LERPs was not difficult. With only one slot for either a major or a captain, and 2 to 4 lieutenants in each of the 13 companies, there were always more volunteers than positions available. Don Wagner, a member of the 101st, was typical.
Well, at that point, you know, the people were starting to make it to Vietnam after all the different schools and all. And the class of 66 and 65, they were especially hard hit, and we started to attend funerals, or there, you know, you would note the funerals up there of young lieutenants, you know, people that you knew or knew of. And of course, as the years went on, that became a little bit more of a part of life up there. You know, the burials, the protests, and things like that. As you got closer to graduation, your choice of branch and your choice of first assignment began to be something you would think about, too.
After graduation, Wagner volunteered for duty in Vietnam.
We had the orders on graduation. Then we had 30 days leave. And then I went to Airborne School, Ranger School, Armor Officer Basic at Fort Knox. And then I think it was PL-51 that said you'd have 4 months of troop duty before you went overseas. So I went out to Fort Carson and was in, the 3rd of the 77th Tank Battalion out there until about July. And then I went to Vietnam in August of 1970.
When he arrived in Vietnam, he was given a platoon.
They call us the ARPS, or the Blues, is what we're called. I'd apparently replaced a lieutenant, and I was never sure of his name until recently, because what they used to call him, they say, you know, sir, the lieutenant that was killed before you. I used to ask him if they couldn't just think of a name, any name, but I just didn't particularly care for that name. It's a good bunch of guys in the rifle platoon. What would happen is if the scouts would find something or a helicopter would go down, our mission was to go out and secure it, or just poke around, do stuff on the ground that they couldn't do from the air.
The mission of the LRFS teams varied according to the needs of the parent unit and the terrain in which they operated. In general, they would observe and or conduct harassing operations against enemy units. Sometimes they would operate as stay-behind units near abandoned forward bases. During these operations, they would conduct hit-and-run ambushes on small enemy bases or direct artillery fire and airstrikes on enemy locations. If a parent unit were operating in the area, they would operate as surveillance units to screen the front and flanks, causing the Viet Cong and NVA troops to disclose themselves or draw them into a firefight. Many units also operated special hunter-killer teams, called Hawkeyes. These teams were dropped in position to overwatch large open areas and kill enemy soldiers and officers with a single well-aimed shot. Just the mere rumor of one of these Hawkeye teams operating in an area would strike fear in the heart of the most hardened VC. The value and the legend of the LRFS were forever solidified when they sighted a large NVA force near the Cambodian border. This sighting alerted Saigon Command to the approaching danger. They saddled up every unit available and threw them at the oncoming enemy. The subsequent operation, Junction City, led to the commitment of 22 brigades. This was to be the largest confrontation of the war to date for U.S. forces. 83 days of combat from February to May 1967. Yielded a confirmed body count of 2,728 North Vietnamese regulars. Vietnam offered a vast variety of terrain and combat conditions. What worked for LRP teams in one area might prove deadly in another. Flexibility was the key to success. According to Lieutenant General Julian Ewell, retired commander of the 9th Infantry Division, at any given time, there were 10 or more different wars in Vietnam, the nature of which would change every day. The biggest change for U.S. ground forces would be the surprise communist offensive during the Lunar New Year truce, Tet. awakening to the sound of explosions. Rear Admiral Kenneth K. Veth, commander, U.S. Naval Forces, Vietnam, moved to the rooftop of his rented house to witness a dazzling display of rockets and flares lighting the Saigon night sky. All around him, the sound of battle in the early hours of January 31st, 1968, heralded the arrival of the 1968 Tet Offensive. Armed with automatic weapons and hand grenades, the Admiral and his housemates waited for the assault on their quarters they knew were coming. During the remaining hours of darkness, Veth kept informed of events by listening to military police and other tactical communications on the radio. Since he spent the night on the roof of his house, he was unable to direct operations from his headquarters. The Admiral was not the only senior commander caught napping. As early as July 1967, the communist leadership and military strategists in North Vietnam were preparing their biggest blow against the forces in the South. Ho Chi Minh and General Vo Nguyen Giap had decided to stage a series of attacks all across South Vietnam. Their intention was to overwhelm the South Vietnamese army and U.S. allies, causing the collapse of the South Vietnamese government. The enemy used a number of feints and deceptions to decoy the U.S. forces as well as the U.S. government. With offers to go to the peace table diverting the attention of President Johnson, attacks such as the siege of Khe Sanh forced the military to concentrate their forces in the countryside and away from the cities. At the same time, NVA forces and supplies were moved down the logistic track of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Stockpiles were built up in the safe areas of Laos and Cambodia. Caches in South Vietnam were filled and more were established. As many as 84,000 Viet Cong and NVA troops were in position to conduct the campaign scheduled to coincide with the Lunar New Year in 1968. Despite numerous warnings from the LRPs and SEAL teams in the field, the intensity, coordination, and timing of the Tet Offensive surprised the American intelligence community in Vietnam. In addition to a flawed intelligence collection effort, command misunderstood critical information, resulting in American forces being improperly deployed and surprised when Saigon and numerous other targets were attacked on January 31st. During the planned Tet truce, Task Force 117, Riverine Force, was scheduled to deploy into western Dien Thuong and eastern Hien Phong provinces, where it was expected to interdict intensified enemy resupply efforts. Captain Robert S. Salzer, the commander of the Riverine Force, later called,
"It was a show-and-tell operation. There was no reason whatsoever to be there. We went up there along the skinniest canal we could, till we ran out of water completely. Then we plowed through the mud some. Nothing much happened. There was no reason for anything to happen. The Viet Cong were all the way to the east of us by this time. So much for what American intelligence thought they knew."
On the morning of January 30th, the task force received word that the Tet truce was canceled. Offensive operations resumed, but infantry units remained near canals for rapid redeployment. The situation in the Delta deteriorated quickly the next morning as enemy forces attacked Binh Tre, Mai To, Cai Le, Cai Bi, and Vinh Long.
"We began to hear rumors that things weren't going quite so well in our splendid isolation. Bill Cowtown, who was a brigadier general, then flew in saying, 'My God, it's Pearl Harbor over again.'"
A Riverine Army company was airlifted to Vinh Long to support Arvin forces at 1810 on the 31st. Another company was flown to reinforce the defenses of the permanent Riverine base at Dong Tam near Mai To. During the night, the majority of the task force withdrew to Dong Tam, where they arrived before dawn despite enemy harassment, including an ineffective ambush. in the fiery glow of the nearby fire. The Riverine force was resupplied and moved out at daybreak. At 1550 on February 1st, these forces were hurled into battle in Montauk and subsequently at Vin Long and Bin Tre. During the fighting, as normal, sources of intelligence temporarily dried up. The Riverine forces became heavily dependent on Air Force-supplied radio direction-finding fixes for information on enemy unit locations. In the end, the Riverine Task Force was credited with saving the Delta. Meanwhile, in anticipation of increased enemy infiltration of supplies from Cambodia, TF-116 River Patrol Force had deployed 9 PBRs, patrol boats, river, to the Cambodian border region. Along with the boats came 8 platoons of SEAL Team 2. The SEALs were based at the U.S. Army Special Forces Camp at Chow Dock on the upper Bassac River in the northwest of the Mekong Delta. They were ordered to Chow Dock to observe a possible large enemy crossing into South Vietnam. 8 was operation with 8 mercenaries from the area, mostly Cambodian and Chinese. What 8 did not realize was that the crossing had already occurred and the 13-man team was picked up by a company of NVA regulars. Platoon 8 was forced to perform a strategic withdrawal. The fight was intense. All of the American strongholds had been overrun. The local Army Special Forces C team was in a barricade situation trying to hold off an enemy battalion. The NVA and Viet Cong had overrun Chow Dock, and now they were about to chew up the Shadow Warriors. The repositioning of PBRs to Chow Dock may have had little impact on infiltration, but the vessels proved crucial in repelling a major ground attack on the city during Tet. Elsewhere during Tet, TF-116 units engaged enemy forces at Ben Tre, Mai To, Vin Long, Sa Dec, the Saigon area, and the LCU, Landing Craft Utility, ramp at Wei. During Tet, Market Time forces became engaged in a number of firefights involving sampans and provided naval gunfire support to forces ashore. Harbor Defense Patrols, Operation Stable Door, engaged enemy swimmers during the early hours of January 31st, but were unable to prevent damage to the bow of the Norwegian tanker Pelican in Cameron Bay.
Warden X-ray, a one, this is Warden X-ray. I have sampan crossing up ahead. I will attempt to intercept. Take off.
Despite extensive commitments in support of Allied forces ashore during the Tet fighting, TF-115 thwarted 4 enemy trawlers at the end of February, attempting to simultaneously infiltrate supplies into the Republic of Vietnam. The task forces played a significant role in the collection of intelligence. For example, in addition to questioning and detaining Vietnamese nationals, TF-116 inserted provincial reconnaissance units and Navy SEAL teams on intelligence collection missions. In support of TF-115, naval aircraft conducted patrols along the Vietnamese coast. In spite of the assets available to U.S. Corps commanders, there was an intelligence failure at Tet. That failure was composed of many elements. U.S. operational commanders generally placed a low emphasis on intelligence collection. And it was only in isolated cases that field commanders were successfully given intelligence briefs and then meaningfully debriefed after an operation. Reports of increased foot traffic from Laos and Cambodia were ignored. Analysis of such information would have assisted the field force in interdicting enemy forces. Rather than utilizing their special warfare skills for intelligence purposes, operating forces often misused the SEALs, Rangers, Lurps, and SOG as covert infantry units. Their abilities to conduct infiltration and reconnaissance, as well as to run agent nets, were often ignored in the rush to employ them in disrupting and destroying specific enemy targets. American crews were affected by pressure to produce. An advisor who served in the Mekong Delta observed, "American PBR crews will stop anybody and take in 50 people and call them suspects if they feel that the pressure is on them to come up with some suspects." The decentralization of special ops control best fitted the different kind of war the individual units and teams had to fight. but it offered little opportunity for these teams to share lessons learned in the field. Despite the fact that the LRPS and SEALs teams were playing a major role in every command in Vietnam, the rest of the Army was still not forming similar units. As a result, on February 18, 1968, the 3rd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division, one of the last units to arrive in Vietnam, did so without a recon organization. President Lyndon Johnson deployed the 82nd Airborne with only 30 hours' notice in response to the communist Tet Offensive that began on January 30th. The brigade was immediately committed to the meat grinder battle raging in the streets of the imperial city of Hue. The initial assembly area for the 3rd Brigade was a new base with an inadequate defensive perimeter and no security system. The brigade commander recognized the need for LRPS as soon as he landed in country and saw the position his troops would operate from. Volunteers were selected from throughout the brigade and assigned to the headquarters company provisional LRP platoon. Within days after landing in the Republic of Vietnam, the LRPS were in the jungles and paddies, providing security and gathering critical intelligence. As Green Beret, Navy SEAL, and Army Rangers were making headlines, one special ops group went entirely unnoticed and wanted to keep it that way. They were the greatest unsung heroes of the war. SOG. SOG was the brainchild of future CIA director William Colby. As Hanoi stepped up infiltration of the South, the U.S. countered with a series of covert attacks on the North. The unit organized to send a message to the communist leaders was the Studies and Observation Group, SOG. It was commanded by an Army colonel, but its team included Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Air Force Commandos, and Rangers. SOG did not answer to the Vietnam Command in Saigon. Its only masters were the Joint Chiefs in Washington. Only five officers in Saigon were ever briefed on SOG.
Well, they had a pretty good system that they worked out with. They even had their own air assets that were attached to SOG that were helicopter assets that would come in and take them out, and they were did a good job. Many, many cases of extraction and fire back.
SOG was authorized to undertake missions not only in South Vietnam, but also in the North, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia.
In fact, SOG, when it starts out in 1964, well, 65, when it goes into Laos, in particular, it catches the enemy off guard, of course. The enemy is used to the Americans not coming into Laos, and suddenly these little teams show up, usually generally staying very, very quiet, and the rules of engagement, again, being not to be seen, not to fire on. And a fair amount of intelligence is brought back. But frankly, how much intelligence can a small team bring back in the greater scope of the Ho Chi Minh Trail? Not very much.
The members of SOG were the best of the best, but even these shadow warriors could not prevail against an enemy that was on the alert.
Problem is, there's only so many clearings in the jungles of Laos. It got to the point where the North Vietnamese militia that guarded the trail called Binh Troms, which were units, regimental-sized units, that were, their whole job was to run the anti-aircraft, run the reaction forces, and keep their section of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. All along the trail is a different Binh Trom. They have this segment. That's all they did. One of their jobs got to be watching the clearings, going after the SOG guys.
The SOG teams were brave. They were awarded 5 medals of honor. But guts alone were not enough.
Now, one thing that SOG veterans say, I'm probably going out of limb here, but a lot of things that they say is that they had a huge impact on the North Vietnamese in Laos and Cambodia in that they tied up regiments, whole regiments of North Vietnamese who had to remain behind to watch for these special forces. Not true. They didn't tie anybody up. That was a job of the Binh Troms that were already there. It didn't matter whether special forces was there or not. They were going to be there doing their job. main force units that were coming into South Vietnam never were tied up against SOG. If you were a Binh Trom in Laos, would you rather have a SOG team come to get you or the 101st Airborne Division? Well, I'd take the SOG team. Dangerous as they are, they're still pretty small. So in the greater scope of things, they did not cause, they were good intelligence gatherers, did not tie troops up inside Laos.
By the mid-60s, SOG's days were numbered.
By 66, 67, like I say, the Vietnamese had gotten pretty good at knowing where they were. So most of the heroic stories you hear of SOG are heroic in the sense that they got found, they're running, and they're trying to get extracted. That's where most of the heroics occur. Well, what's the original mission of these guys? It's to stay quiet and undetected. So by the late period, by 67, certainly 68 and 69, the average time on the ground was very, very short. By late period, SOG was fighting a lot, and they were fighting because they'd been spotted and seen, and there's just no way around it. Like I say, you can't come in. There's only so many places you can land in. You know. They could have walked over the border, but that would have taken, you know, weeks or months sometimes because it's just too far. Not very good for the mission.
By 1971, SOG was disbanded officially. But during their secretive years, SOG had logged a combat record unequaled in U.S. history. SOG's improvisations helped forge today's special ops doctrine for units such as Delta Force. It is no coincidence that U.S. special ops teams that probed deep behind the lines in Iraq were on blue light duty, the concept of which was developed by SOG.
There's a high-flying bird way up in the sky, and I wonder, does he look down as he flies on by, riding on the air so easy.